Okay, so the first question is, can you tell me where you were born and how'd you wind up in Long Beach? What happened and everything in between?
Well, my parents took a homestead in Oregon, and I was born there. City. And it wasn't in the city, it was in the country. They had a little farm where my father grew alfalfa. And they were there for a few years and then came back to Southern California, to Long Beach, and settled there. They were fortunate. My mother received some land on Signal Hill from her father, and it turned into oil property, so they had a pretty good income, so we didn't have to worry too much about money during the Depression, although we weren't wealthy. I went to school in Long Beach, and it was the Depression time then when I graduated from high school and no jobs, and I joined the Navy just more for the adventure than anything. Spent 4 years in the Navy, came out and worked at Douglas Aircraft for a while, and then the war started looming over the horizon, and I realized I was going to have to go back in the Navy, so I joined the Army. And signed up for the Aviation Cadet Program and got into the Air Force, which wasn't the Air Force then. It was the Air Corps, Army Air Corps, and flew airplanes for the military during the war. After the war, I went back to school and finished college. Taught school for about 19 years in Southern California. And then later moved to Northern California, where I live now.
Describe your war experience just in a little bit more detail. Why did you think you were, what were your motives for going into the military to begin with? And did those motives change?
Well, actually, I wasn't too military oriented, but I went into the military mainly because I had taken flying lessons when I was 15 years old in the old biplanes, and I loved that sort of activity, and I figured I might get a little more of that in the military. It was all selfish.
During the period that I was in the military, I flew fighters in Germany on escort from the 8th Air Force. Yeah, stationed in England.
So what? Yeah. So what? Kind of lead us into the time you got shot down. What happened?
Well, as I say, we were just on escort, going back and forth across the channel, escorting bombers into Germany, and I was shot down by ground fire while attacking trains in a marshaling yard. And that was the last 3 months of the war. I spent that in a prison camp. That ended my military career as far as active duty went. I stayed in the reserve, however, and retired in the 70s from the reserve, yeah.
Okay. So, what can you describe kind of the rationales for World War II as most people tended to see them at the time, and what do you think of those rationales in retrospect? Was, you know, Studs Terkel called World War II the good war? You know, how valid do you think that is?
Well, most people felt that it was a good war, I think, because Hitler was the big threat, and people all over the world were concerned about Hitler's tendency to want to dominate the world. But what they didn't realize was that everybody wants to dominate the world, the United States especially, and the United States had built up Germany after World War I, so that they were in a position to execute World War II. So there was more to it than just right and wrong. It was a matter of economics, and people were getting wealthy on the warfare, and that's the way it is today.
Apparently, we keep hearing more and more about this too lately. They,
we bought up supposedly some of these good Nazis after the war, and then they apparently became installed directly into our government, and specifically groups like the CIA and even NASA, we're hearing now, have some really strong Nazi elements.
Well, it's hard for me to talk about that. I don't know too much about the internal workings, but it's pretty obvious that the Nazis did have a big influence on the United States, especially with their construction of the atomic bomb. And whether they got installed in government or not, I'm not aware, but it's not hard to believe this, the way the situation exists today. The United States, since World War II, has gone around either buying or coercing other countries into their will, purportedly for the control of communism, world communism, as they choose to call it. And while communism, actually, I don't think was any serious threat like they would have the people believe, that was the thing that they used to scare people into doing as they wanted them to do. We see the same thing today. Instead of communism, they're liberals we're supposed to be afraid of.
Yeah, and people that, drug users and other groups.
Well, and other groups, of course, are picked on.
Yeah, what you said that communism was the excuse that they, and I assume they being the powers and the corporations, used to get people to go along. From the power elite's point of view, why do you think communism was a threat?
What would happen if people started embracing those concepts?
There would be a loss of monetary intake. The corporations wouldn't be allowed to exist in the capacity that they do today. They wouldn't be able to make all that money. They keep raking it in and downsizing, as they like to call it these days, but it puts a lot of people out of work. And they send their companies overseas because they can get cheap labor, puts a lot of people out of work here, and pays terrible salaries to the people overseas. So it's really not doing anyone any good except the people at the top who are raking in the big salaries. And people can't see that generally. They have people leading them like Rush Limbaugh, who espouses one party over another, but actually when he's saying all these negative things about politicians, he's speaking for all of the politicians and about them.
What do you think is the problem with having certain, don't even know what to call them, for-profit enterprises like health, for example, education, even access to news and information? Do you think those things are best handled by market forces, or should there be some kind of a nationalized form of those?
I think that nationalization is the way to go in most cases. In the case of the United States, it's hard to say that because the government is so influenced by the corporations that the people really can't get a fair deal from them. The corporations are the ones in the United States that set the policy. And the people voting locally might have some influence on certain issues, but nationally it doesn't help much. The situation is controlled, as I say, by corporations, and they set the policy.
And nationalization seems to be the major crime. I mean, when foreign leaders try to nationalize their own interest in their own countries, the United States tends to vilify them and call them evil and, you know, use the media to get Americans to hate them in about a week, like they did, for example, to Gaddafi. Didn't he try to nationalize the country's oil? And that's the main reason that they vilified him.
Yeah, they've done that over and over. They during the Spanish-American War, first of all, the war with Mexico was fought largely because of nationalization. The Mexicans wanted their holdings for themselves, And the United States, the government was busy taking land away from them, like Texas, California, and fooling the people into thinking that they were doing the right thing.
Well, like at the Alamo, they use that experience, that situation to, like they always do, to mobilize people into anger and to get the people to justify their military actions against the natives.
Well, as far as the Alamo goes, the way I heard it was, there were only 8 Texans at the Alamo when the battle was fought, and they were all Mexicans. So there weren't very many Yankees, we'll call them, fighting at the Alamo.
But it made a good news story, and it get people into, you know, fighting.
Of course, they get people into the fighting mood no matter what, by saying the right things and waving the flag, and people don't give it much thought. They just act on emotions.
So, like, how would you characterize the general nature of most of our military, our meaning the corporations that run things, how would you characterize their military policies worldwide? What are they actually trying to do right now, worldwide?
Well, they keep the world safe for democracy as we know it in America.
In corporate capitalism.
Which is American democracy in action. Yes, and the corporations are set up so that they can make these huge profits, but they're not satisfied with the ones they make here. They want profits all over the world, and they talk about a one-world government, which is what the people were fearing. The people were fearing that a few years ago, and they were being led into fearing it. Now the world government is... Oh, I'm getting all screwed up.
How would you characterize the difference between democracy and corporate capitalism? Is there a difference? They seem to pose it as the same thing in America.
Well, yeah, that's the idea. They pose it as democracy, and then people go for it. Actually, it's not really democracy. Democracy is a government that's run by the people. The people have a say in their affairs. In the United States, that isn't really true. They have no say in their affairs. They think they have, but they haven't. It's all governed by politicians, local and national, and their profits, meager as they might be, all come from those sources.
How would you characterize, like, a capitalistic country such as, like, Indonesia or Turkey, that's extremely repressive, as opposed to a capitalistic country like Germany that has all kinds of social benefits for its people? What's the difference in capitalism there?
Well, I don't think the difference is as much in capitalism as it is in mindset. Some of those nations, like Turkey, for example, have been ruled by strong dictators for a long time, and they have that sort of policy set. Whereas Germany is a little more flexible. They're ruled by a government that considers the people's wishes a little more, which makes it a little more democratic. But the word democracy fools a lot of people, and a person should study democracy a little bit as to the correct meaning of the word before they start making pronouncements about how wonderful it is or how evil it is.
Well, a lot of people that call themselves constitutionalists, I found, have never read the Constitution, so they're kind of imagining what it consists of and projecting onto it whatever they seem to want to project onto it. So, I want to talk about the 60s. What do you think what happened during the 60s represents?
That's a real puzzle, what happened during the 60s. That was... It looked like a social revolution at the time, and a welcome one at that, because it was sorely needed.
What do you think precipitated it?
Well, it's hard to say, but I kind of have a suspicion that drugs helped to do that, because so many people were experimenting with drugs, and drugs have a tendency to open your mind and make you see a little more clearly some things that were a little cloudy before. I know that isn't a popular viewpoint, that people don't like to say that. They don't like to give any credibility at all to drugs, but it is true that these drugs do open your mind a little more, and the government didn't want that to happen.
Is that why they're illegal?
Exactly. That's exactly it. That's why marijuana, which is a very benign drug, is kept illegal so vociferously, because of the damage the fathers think it's going to do to the children.
Obviously, the people don't quite agree with the government on the efficacy of marijuana. What are your thoughts on the medical benefits of marijuana?
I think the medical benefits are there if they just allow them to come out. There's been a lot more research done on marijuana than is known. It's been suppressed, of course. It was used as medicine in the 30s in the United States before it was made illegal in 1937. And it was used to good advantage. But it's been suppressed ever since then. Law enforcement insists that it has no known medical use, which is a deliberate lie, because it certainly has. It's been used for thousands of years as folk medicine all over the world. But folk medicine is denigrated by people who purported to, who
yes. Go ahead.
It's denigrated by people who the marijuana is denigrated by people who have had no experience with it or who are profiteering from it in some way, either financially or politically. And it's kept illegal deliberately and with malice. I think that they should allow marijuana to be used as medicine without a doubt. It could make an excellent medicine for many things, especially depression, because it increases one's tolerance level, both emotionally and physically, and would be very helpful to especially old people who are beginning to be in pain from their age.
Have you ever personally used it?
Yes, I have. Well, from my use of asbestos, I found myself in a position where I could no longer smoke it. So I started using it in the form of little cakes and eating a little bit. It gave me such relief from my illness that I found that it was well worthwhile.
Can you describe its effects?
Well,
did it make you all stoned out and laughing crazily?
No, and it didn't make me rush down the street with a machete chopping people's heads off or jumping out of 10-story buildings. Didn't do any of those things. It just made me feel more pacific, and it made it easier to deal with the problem. Makes a person more optimistic.
Considering like other drugs too, like psychedelic drugs, LSD, psilocybin, that people were taking in large quantities during that period, did that have some effect on like the fashion styles of the period? And what was going on there? People started dressing totally differently than they ever had before. Where did that come from, in your opinion?
Well, they told us at the time that those fashions were a rebellion against the fashions that were in vogue at the time. And it was considered nice to be clean and neat, have a haircut, and so you'll find that the younger people did all those things just the opposite.
Well, you know, now the media is trying to act like the 60s people were bad parents, like their kids are out of control from all these values that they got during the 60s. But it makes me wonder about the parents that of the kids in the 60s, you know. What did they do wrong, you know? Did that previous generation have a mindset that the kids rebelled against, and what was going on?
That's a pretty vague question.
Well, I'll have to give you a vague answer on that, because I'm not sure that I know or have any real idea on the subject. The children of that period took off on a different tangent, and we should recognize that as being something worthwhile. They called themselves love children. They were giving peace signs. They were against the war. They espoused all the things that we considered evil. And yet our government was so against them. did everything in his power to destroy them. And now, look at the children today. They're shooting each other on the school grounds and gang warfare, and I think we'd all settle gladly for a little of that love now.
At least these kids have short hair now.
Well, yeah, now it's too short.
Could one element in this be that that previous generation to the 60s children really were suckers for the government? I mean, whatever the government said, they tended to believe. And certain things happened in the 60s, like, for example, the assassination of Kennedy, that made people at least suspect down deep, if not realize, that they were being flat-out lied to. Did that have some effect on what happened in the 60s?
I'm sure it did. The people became more aware after the assassination of Kennedy that there were things going on. They even started talking about Abraham Lincoln's assassination then, and showing where that was a conspiracy as well. So the trust in the government has somewhat deflated since that period.
The sad thing is, it's like almost all Americans, whether they're on the left or right of the political spectrum, tend to distrust the government, but for some reason we can't coordinate our efforts. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, maybe it's because we're in such a habit of this warfare between the Democrats and Republicans. Our government's become nothing but a little battleground between the two parties as to which one is going to be in power, and they lose sight of doing anything really constructive for the country. Probably this big economic mess we're in now wouldn't be as bad if they had coordinated their efforts a little more toward something constructive instead of just fighting to see who's going to be in charge.
Isn't this economic mess that you describe, doesn't that only apply to like a large percentage of the poor folks in the country? I mean, a certain element of the society is doing really well.
Yeah, the wealthy always do well because they have this wealth stashed away and it keeps building on itself, but the poor people don't have that, and they're often criticized for not being entrepreneurs and getting out there and building and constructing and charging money and making themselves wealthy. But many people don't have that ability, and they might have other abilities even more useful, but it doesn't make them wealthy. That doesn't mean that they're bad citizens or less than the ones that make the wealth. In fact, they have been useful in accumulating this wealth for the bosses. The bosses don't give them the consideration they should. They keep sharp tools to do their work, but the labor force, which is the most important tool they have, they just treat with very great neglect.
Well, the corporate philosophy seems to be that you have a right to charge as little as you can force workers to work for, and that those Republicans call that market forces. I don't see the difference between that and this slavery mentality. You have a right to make slaves of people if you can. Isn't that the same argument?
Yeah, that's the same thing. But that's always been the case since the Industrial Revolution. Sweatshops have existed. Bosses have tried to keep these people under their thumb and pay them as little as possible and not spend any money on working conditions to improvement. And as a result, the people have suffered and they've gone into labor unions, which is a bad word now to say labor or unions. But without the labor unions, the worker today would have nothing.
Do you foresee a rejuvenation of the labor movement in the United States?
Well, it seems that they're making a little comeback right now, but it's hard to tell just how strong it's going to be.
Well, in this global economy, of course, workers are totally hampered by the effects of NAFTA and GATT. Do you have any comments on those two?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. They send the companies into countries that have a lower standard of living, and they can get the workers to work for much cheaper. In fact, even lower their wages in some place, I understand, at the expense of the worker. And
do you think the corporations are consciously trying to erode the living standards and wages of workers in this country?
Well, I think they want to erode them to the extent that the worker doesn't get it into his head that he's any more than a worker.
So they, in the 60s, 70s, when people started fighting for their rights a little bit more and they started actually getting some increased wages and such, that kind of cut into the enormous profits of the corporation, and that just can't happen, huh?
Yes, that, and also the small business people got to thinking that they were equal to the big business people, and now some of these smaller business people and the people that made good salaries equate themselves with the elite, the ruling elite. That's where they're making their big mistake, because they're not the ruling elite. They're working for the ruling elite and don't realize it.
They hope that someday that they'll be rich, and so they kind of identify with this fantasy that they have.
That's it. Ronald Reagan said that in a few words. He said that he was glad to be in a country where you could get rich. That was the main thing, you could get rich.
Well, maybe you could tell me a little bit more about your philosophy in relationship to that. Do you think that life's just about accumulating, you know, so-called wealth?
No, I don't. I think it's accumulating enough so that you can be comfortable and do what you want to do. And, of course, people want to do different things, but you can have an interesting life if you have interest in certain things, and you don't need millions to back you up. You can get along on thousands. But trouble is, when you have you live in a country where it's famous for becoming rich, too many people are greedy and they want to be rich. Any government, I think, any form of government would work if people would allow it to. Communism would work if people would allow it to. But people are so greedy that they won't let it work. And that's the same trouble with capitalism. People are greedy and they're amassing wealth at the top and ignoring the worker at the bottom. And that's the way maybe it'll always be.
Well, as far as catering to greed, though, capitalism probably is definitely the best system for that, wouldn't you say?
I would say yes. Yes, capitalism is a good system for catering to greed.
What are your theories on the reasons for the drug war? Do you think that the drug war was established because there really was a justified drug abuse problem in America that needed to be remedied in such a fashion, or did the government have other purposes?
Well, I think the drug war is something that should be remedied in the country. It certainly has an undermining effect. But there are other ways to go about it than to have a war. The United States lately wants to have a war at everything. Everything's a war. And probably one of the greatest purposes of it is to get the people under control. They can get more equipment and more means to control drugs and people. And pretty soon...
You've heard theories, I'm sure, about the U.S. complicity, government complicity in certain drug operations. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, I'm thinking Vietnam War, it was heroin. In Central America, it was cocaine. There's allegations, you know, by Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News, backed up allegations that the CIA was bringing cocaine into the inner cities. Gary Webb was obviously trashed and discredited by the mainstream media, but I think people that have checked into that know that he has a really strong case. The standard of proof for those articles was much, much higher than most newspapers would ever give to normal things that they print every day. So any ideas about the government's connection to the drug trade?
Well, that's a hard one for an ordinary citizen to come up with, but there's been too much evidence to the idea that the government, some elements at least of the government, have participated in drug trafficking themselves. That was made pretty clear during the Contra routine. And the triangles, there's the Golden Triangle and the Bermuda Triangle.
They don't grow too much stuff out in the ocean.
A lot of seaweed.
Psychedelic plankton.
Yeah.
Let's see, what am I going to say? Afghanistan was another opium-growing region that the CIA was trying to control, I believe.
The CIA has operated in many countries where it's been customary to grow opium and different products, different plants that lend themselves to drugs. But they have also used the drugs themselves to finance their projects, and it seems pretty obvious that this is true from testimonials that have been given by pilots and different people that have been involved. You can't just dismiss those stories. There are too many of them.
I think it's just not a coincidence that everywhere our government has been operating for any length of time, they seem to leave behind a functioning drug cartel.
Well, it seems like there is a connection between the government and drug activities in other countries.
In Vietnam, it was what?
In Vietnam, it was, well, they started out saying there's marijuana there, but pretty soon they were bringing heroin in. And then during the Contra period, they were using cocaine was their product. Well, the products were related to those areas that they were operating in. So it seemed quite natural that they'd be bringing in the drugs that from the countries that they were operating in. That alone makes it suspicious.
It seems like it's kind of impossible to win the drug war that the government has erected if the government's also bringing drugs into the country, wouldn't you?
Yes, I don't think the government's going to win any drug wars. They invest a lot of time and money in it, but it's not going to win the war. The only thing that's going to win that war is if they deal with it in some other way that's a little more sensible. And I have ideas on that. I think if they'd legalize it and then restrict use. Well, I don't think they're going to win any drug wars, but I think they probably could control drug traffic a little better if they would probably legalize it and then restrict its use with the controls the way they do on other certain drugs now.
Are you talking about all drugs? Or just marijuana?
No, I'm talking about drugs in general. Marijuana, of course, is another matter. That's been restricted for so long that older people were of the impression that it was an evil thing. They're not realizing how it could help them. Then in California, they had this vote a while back on Proposition 215. And older folks by then had gotten the idea that maybe it was going to help them. And a lot of people that didn't vote for it before voted for it. Now, there's a good example of democracy in action. Because the will of the people was completely ignored. 215 has been ignored, overridden. The cops are still busting people. And they're still going on television and the law enforcement warning people how evil marijuana is. The doctors have been threatened with persecution or prosecution if they recommend that a person needs it. The only argument they have is, well, they have a substitute now for marijuana. It's synthetic Marinol, and Marinol is so expensive that no one can buy it, so it's useless.
Okay. Yeah, it struck me recently in the news when we've been hearing, you know, they recalled FinFan and those drugs that have ephedrine in it. Remember during the Prop 215 campaign, and Dan Lundgren was just going on and on about how marijuana wasn't valid because it hadn't been through all those tests and safeguards that the FDA, you know, put a drug through to make it legitimate. It crossed my mind that FinFin apparently was approved by the FDA, but then they found out later that it was hurting people. So doesn't that seem to kind of undermine the FDA's?
Well, it was somewhat that way with thalidomide, too.
They want to bring that back.
Yeah, they're going to bring that back. They found out that they could use it for something else. But one thing that occurs to me is that many people that are against marijuana now are younger people. They don't remember the 30s when all this reefer madness nonsense was running rampant. And they have believed all these years that it was an evil drug. Now when it's shown that it isn't, we still get our politicians haranguing us that it's evil and it's a stepping stone to other drugs, and they're threatening the doctors with persecution or prosecution. Many of the doctors are younger doctors, and they don't remember the research that was done on it. They'll say now, well, I think that it needs more research to be done, not really realizing that there has been research on it, and that's been suppressed. They take a dim view of anecdotal evidence that there's some good to it, but marijuana, along with many of its other attributes, is a pretty good medicine for lowering blood pressure, but it's not widely known. I learned that from two doctors, well-known doctors down in Southern California, who are lecturing at Irvine University back in the 60s.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was your trip to Taiwan that you made, which was that 1989 that you came? Yeah. So I guess the first question is, I remember that night you stepped off the plane and, you know, we're suddenly in Jung League, walking down the street toward the night market. And can you just characterize kind of your first general impression of Taiwan? I mean, you'd never been in Asia before.
Yeah, my first impression was we were having a big fiesta. It's a big party going on. The streets were all lined with banners, and there was no writing anywhere. You couldn't read anything. You couldn't read street numbers or anything. They were all in these funny little characters, and these big banners that hung in front of all the shops were the titles of the shops. They were the drug stores and the hardware stores and all the stores that we know here. Only they didn't appear to be because of the way that it had been written, or they had been signed, I should say. The streets were full of people hawking wares, snake blood and things like that. Things that were altogether foreign to my life over here. And when I heard these remarks made that there was a culture shock, I at last realized what that meant. I had been sort of in favor over the years of Mao's takeover of China because I was adverse to the doings of Chiang Kai-shek. And to make my first visit to an Asiatic country in Chiang's country was quite a novelty. But the people that were there were just busy as Chinamen anywhere, just doing all their little tasks.
Making money. You were there long enough to notice kind of how the daily markets work, the night markets, things like that. Did you notice any poverty, homeless people like you do here? And if not, why do you think the difference?
I don't know. I haven't given that much thought, but I didn't notice any homeless people. They were all doing something. If people want to be entrepreneurs here, but they usually have some big corporation in mind that they want to head. Over there, a man takes his little cart out in the street and sells some little goodies that he makes to the people passing along. That's his business and the way he makes his living. Some of the food they had to offer wouldn't be accepted too readily by Westerners, but it pleased the people there and it kept everyone busy.
So one of the differences may be that, in an ironic way, I mean, martial law had only been lifted a few years since I got there in 89, but in certain ways there seemed to be more free enterprise. There weren't all the bureaucratic regulations and obstacles to setting up a little business, so everyone had a way to make money easily.
That's right. That was a very striking thing about the whole country. The freedom that we have here, we tout so gloriously, faded away a little bit after I saw the freedom in Taiwan. We know that other countries don't have the freedom we have here. We have freedom of speech. You can say anything you want, but you don't dare do anything about it. Over there, they don't dare say anything about it, but they can do a lot more. In Taiwan, I saw people parking their motorcycles on the sidewalk and driving up on the sidewalk to park and going against traffic, and No one was getting the ticket. The only one that had any dealings with the police were people that had collided. And they didn't seem to be too concerned about that. So there was an element of freedom going on there that I had not seen before.
What did you think of the Wendy's hamburgers in Taiwan?
Well, I thought that was, they were a little misplaced. But the people over there seemed to welcome them. They were always busy.
Yeah, I was impressed with the spaghetti they served at Wendy's with chopsticks.
Yeah, chopsticks and spaghetti don't seem to go together to a Westerner much.
Were there any other facets of the social life over there that interested you? You got to see Xinhua, which is a little rural village where I had lived for a while, and you saw how some of the people related to me, I think. Do you remember seeing little kids come up to me or both of us and how they related to white folks?
Yeah, they acted as though they hadn't seen white people before. The little kids would come up and pull a hair on my son's arms and make little remarks that I couldn't understand.
One of those remarks was something like Bai Hotsu, which meant the white monkey.
Yeah, the surprising thing, though, was that in that day and age, that the white man would be such a strange sight to people anywhere in the world, because the white man had gone all over the world trying to throw governments wherever he went.
The white devil syndrome, yeah. You know, one night, some students of mine treated us to a little meal at the restaurant that they owned, the seafood restaurant. Remember that little incident with the soup? You want to relate that story?
Oh, yes. They had this delicious soup, and they had a little burner on the table that kept it hot. And the soup got a little low in the bowl, and they brought in some ingredients to put in the soup, and among the ingredients was a little dish of fish, live fish, swimming around in this water, and they were going to put those in the hot soup and cook them alive. And that was just too much for me. I couldn't quite get that, and I objected that it would cause them pain, but they all stood around with puzzled looks on their face. They couldn't understand why I was objecting. That's the way they'd always made their soup.
Yeah, so in general, that offered a pretty good insight, I think, into the typical Chinese relationship to animals. And how do you feel about that, and do you think that is consonant with what otherwise purports to be a Buddhist country?
No, somehow there's a little discrepancy there, but I've noticed that in many other countries people don't have a kind regard for animals.
Like many people,
yeah, everyone, many people here don't have a kind regard for animals, and in fact they treat animals terribly.
Did you notice generally how, you know, the average Taiwanese person's consciousness in terms of ecology and like when you riding through on the train, you see people just chuck trash out the window and such. I mean, generally they don't seem too ecologically aware. Did you, after seeing Taiwan, did it change your views about the ecological consciousness in the United States?
Yeah, I was given a little boost on that score. The people here seem to be much more aware of the dangers to the ecology than in other countries. In China, they did carelessly throw things out the window of the train, and they would burn black smoke plastics in yards along the rail track that sent up billows of horrible black smoke that no one seemed to pay any attention to. The buses would give off obnoxious gases, and if you'd walk down the street, there'd be a layer of smoke that hit you about the navel, and you'd be walking along in a layer of smoke. The streets were just littered with motorcycles and cars and everything spewing forth their smoke, and no one seemed to pay any attention to it. But one of the young Chinese there said that he remembered back in 20 years before when they were kids and they were swimming in the river and the rivers were clean. But to look at the rivers now, you'd never be able to dream of a clean river. They were just nasty looking, oozy messes.
Every year they have the Dragon Boat Festival in Taipei. and occasionally one of these boats will tip over and the people get these nasty diseases from having been in the river. So yeah, things have changed a lot. And how would you account for that sudden change over the last 20 years? What happened? Why did Taiwan suddenly make this tremendous, change towards industrialization? Who helped them?
Oh, well, obviously the United States. Chiang Kai-shek's China was the United States' China. And the industrialists here, had to get their businesses going over there, of course, because they could work there with greater advantage, monetary and otherwise. And it was the United States who country going into a lesser country, or what they consider to be a lesser country, and invoking ways that were contrary to the things that were taught in the United States, but there was a disregard for the welfare of the people there to let these things, these terrible things, exist.
You remember our trip to Hualien? What do you remember about that trip?
That was a beautiful trip on a train, beautiful scenery all the way. And when I got into Hualien, I was surprised. The town reminded me somewhat of Santa Cruz. And it was a clean, nice-looking town. It wasn't so thickly settled that you were mingled with highly dense populated areas.
Yeah, Hualien's on the east coast of Taiwan. It's the Pacific side. Large marble capital. If you go to the beach there, they have these huge boulders, rocks, very smooth, round rocks, heavy and big, and a lot of them are marble. But if you're not careful, you get out there in the surf, and you suddenly, it's like being in a washing machine with these big rocks. And the water's real warm and nice, but I came out all bruised and banged up my first trip in the ocean. But you remember our trip to James' house, and can you describe what you remember about James' domicile?
Well, why would you want to know about that? I mean, that's something you should keep quiet about.
Describe the toilet for us.
The house itself was a Japanese house. It had been built there during the Japanese occupation, and it was a well-constructed house, but it had sort of fallen into disrepair because of the occupants' disregard for the old setup. The bathroom had been somewhat neglected. The toilet room was just so obnoxious that you can hardly believe it. It had been neglected for ages. There had been no cleaning woman taking care of that.
What kind of toilet was it, remember?
I don't remember. Just the ordinary toilet, as I recall.
I'm thinking James had two places in Hualien. I think I remember the one you're thinking of. We were also at another house in Hualien, I believe, when there was a party there. You remember that night?
Yes, I do.
James had his house was right on the hill, and then across the street was the ocean. Is this the one you're thinking of? And the toilet was that squat toilet?
No, I think we're getting our toilets mixed up.
CMA, and the people say that most every day we improve. Everything is fine when we're all in line, and the fellows of our school are in step. Oh, it's squads right here, and it's squads left there, and it's all in the break of the day. In work or fun, we're always on the run. It's the SCMA. Hi.
Later this month, California voters will decide whether to allow a resumption.